Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Comunidad Autónoma de Canarias. Pruebas de certificación de nivel avanzado C1 de inglés. Convocatoria ordinaria de 2023. Prueba de comprensión de textos orales. Esta parte consta de 3 tareas. Escuchará cada grabación 2 veces. Escuche y lea las instrucciones al principio de cada tarea y realícela según se indica. Las respuestas escritas a lápiz o en tinta roja no se calificarán. No está permitido el uso del diccionario. El uso de cualquier dispositivo electrónico queda prohibido durante la prueba. El móvil tendrá que permanecer apagado y guardado. Atención, no escriba en los recuadros sombreados. Son espacios reservados para la calificación de las tareas.
Task 1. Listen to 6 people talking about birth order and personality and match them, speakers 1 to 6, to what they talk about, phrases A to J. Write your answers in the table provided. There are 3 extra phrases you do not need. Extract 0 is an example. Now you have 1 minute to read the task. Speaker 0. Example.
Sigmund Freud had a theory whereby firstborns were the better category because he was himself a firstborn. But then Alfred Adler, another psychoanalyst, thought that firstborns were actually quite neurotic and maladjusted because they had this sense of being dethroned by laterborns. So he actually thought middleborns were the best rank to have because they're the best adjusted. And not surprisingly, he was a middleborn.
Speaker 1.
I think I take on qualities of both an oldest and a youngest. I have 3 older brothers and 1 younger sister, and I'm the first girl. So I was the last born for about 10 years before my sister came along. So that's where being the last born, I have some tendency to be a little spoiled, some would say. I think my brothers would say that.
Speaker 2.
Older siblings perceive themselves to have a sense of responsibility towards the little ones and a divine right to tell their younger siblings what to do. Younger siblings regarded older siblings as, on the positive side, caring, on the negative side, bossy. The word bossy came up quite regularly. Older siblings talked about younger siblings copying them, irritating them by wanting them to give them attention.
Speaker 3.
What we found is that also the later-born children outperformed their earlier-born siblings, so completely the reverse pattern. In the developed countries, you find that parents spend more time with the earlier-born children, and in contrast, you find in Ecuador that mothers actually spend more time with the later-born children, playing, reading, helping with homework, etc.
Speaker 4.
Firstborns tend to be more conscientious than their younger siblings, at least in the context of the family environment. And since they act as surrogate parents and identify with parents in authority, they're more likely to do their homework And to the extent that they do act as a surrogate parent, they have to adopt a certain level of responsibility that the younger sibling doesn't necessarily have to worry about.
Speaker 5.
You're their first kid. They're kind of experimenting with you. They don't really know what to do, so they're very cautious. I wouldn't be allowed to go to sleepovers when I was younger. I had a curfew. My mom needed to know who I was with. I felt like every 5 minutes calling in, texting, seeing what I was doing or what I was up to. My little sister, she goes to sleepovers all the time. And I always tell my parents, oh, how come she gets to get away with the sleepovers, but I wasn't allowed to when I was her age.
Speaker 6.
Where are you located in the family plays quite an important role. So firstborn, on average, tend to do better than secondborn. Secondborns tend to do better than thirdborn, and so on. For the U.S., that is the context that we end up looking at, we may be talking up to a year of education within the same family. On average, you can see difference of maybe half a year with respect to the secondborn and a full year with respect to the thirdborn.
Listen again. Speaker 0. Example.
Sigmund Freud had a theory whereby firstborns were the better category because he was himself a firstborn. But then Alfred Adler, another psychoanalyst, thought that firstborns were actually quite neurotic and maladjusted because they had this sense of being dethroned by laterborns. So he actually thought middleborns were the best rank to have because they're the best adjusted. And not surprisingly, he was a middleborn.
Speaker 1.
I think I take on qualities of both an oldest and a youngest. I have 3 older brothers and 1 younger sister, and I'm the first girl. So I was the last born for about 10 years before my sister came along. So that's where being the last born, I have some tendency to be a little spoiled, some would say. I think my brothers would say that.
Speaker 2.
Older siblings perceive themselves to have a sense of responsibility towards the little ones and a divine right to tell their younger siblings what to do. Younger siblings regarded older siblings as, on the positive side, caring, on the negative side, bossy. The word bossy came up quite regularly. Older siblings talked about younger siblings copying them, irritating them by wanting them to give them attention.
Speaker 3.
What we found is that also the later born children outperformed their earlier born siblings, so completely the reverse pattern. In the developed countries, you find that parents spend more time with the earlier born children, and in contrast, you find in Ecuador that mothers actually spend more time with the later born children, playing, reading, helping with homework, etc.
Speaker 4.
Firstborns tend to be more conscientious than their younger siblings, at least in the context of the family environment. And since they act as surrogate parents and identify with parents in authority, they're more likely to do their homework. And to the extent that they do act as a surrogate parent, they have to adopt a certain level of responsibility that the younger sibling doesn't necessarily have to worry about.
Speaker 5.
You're their first kid. They're kind of experimenting with you. They don't really know what to do, so they're very cautious. I wouldn't be allowed to go to sleepovers when I was younger. I had a curfew. My mom needed to know who I was with. I felt like every 5 minutes calling in, texting, seeing what I was doing or what I was up to. My little sister, she goes to sleepovers all the time. And I always tell my parents, oh, how come she gets to get away with the sleepovers, but I wasn't allowed to when I was her age.
Speaker 6.
Where are you located in the family plays quite an important role. So firstborn, on average, tend to do better than secondborn. Secondborns tend to do better than thirdborn, and so on. For the U.S., that is the context that we end up looking at, we may be talking up to a year of education within the same family. On average, you can see difference of maybe half a year with respect to the secondborn and a full year with respect to the thirdborn.
This is the end of task one. Now turn to task two. Task two. Listen to a TED talk about a hearing condition called tinnitus. According to the talk, complete the following sentences 1 to 9 in no more than 5 words. Write your answers in the table provided. Sentence 0 is an example. Now you have 1 minute and 30 seconds to read the task.
Arriving home after a long day, you settle in for a quiet evening alone. But instead of the sound of silence, you hear a constant ringing, even though there's nothing making any noise. What you're experiencing is called tinnitus, the perception of a noise like ringing, buzzing, hissing, or clicking that occurs without any external source of sound. Tinnitus has been bothering humanity since ancient Babylon. plaguing everyone from Leonardo da Vinci to Charles Darwin. Today, roughly 1 in 7 people worldwide experiences this auditory sensation. So where does this persistent sound come from? When you normally hear something, sound waves hit various areas of your ear, creating vibrations that displace fluid inside the cochlea. If the vibrations are large enough, they elicit a chemical response that transforms them into bioelectrical signals. These nerve impulses are then relayed through the hearing pathway to the brain, where they result in the sounds we perceive. However, in the vast majority of tinnitus cases, the nerve signals that produce these mysterious sounds don't travel through your ear at all. Instead, they're generated internally by your own central nervous system. Under usual circumstances, these self-produced signals are an essential part of hearing. All mammals demonstrate ongoing neural activity throughout their hearing pathways. When there are no sounds present, this activity is at a baseline that establishes your neural code for silence. When a sound does appear, this activity changes, allowing the brain to distinguish between silence and sound. But the auditory system's health can affect this background signal. Loud noises, diseases, toxins, and even natural aging can damage your cochlear cells. Some of these may heal in a matter of hours. However, if enough cells die, either over time or all at once, the auditory system becomes less sensitive. With fewer cochlear cells relaying information, incoming sounds generate weaker nerve signals, and many environmental sounds can be lost completely. To compensate, your brain devotes more energy to monitoring the hearing pathway. Just like you might adjust the knobs of a radio, the brain modifies neural activity while also tweaking the tuning knob to get a clearer signal. Increasing this background neural activity is intended to help you process weak auditory inputs. But it can also modify your baseline for silence, such that a lack of sound no longer sounds silent at all. This is called subjective tinnitus, and it accounts for the vast majority of tinnitus cases. Subjective tinnitus is a symptom associated with practically every known ear disorder, but it isn't necessarily a bad thing. While its appearance can be surprising, subjective tinnitus has no inherently negative consequences. But for some, tinnitus episodes can trigger traumatic memories or otherwise distressing feelings, which increase the sound's intrusiveness. This psychological loop often leads to what's known as bothersome tinnitus, a condition that can exacerbate the symptoms of PTSD, insomnia, anxiety, and depression. There's no known cure for subjective tinnitus, so the most important thing doctors can do is help people understand this auditory event and develop neutral associations with these often distressing sounds. One form, called informational masking, uses soothing, complex auditory signals that distract the brain from the tinnitus sound. Another, called energetic masking, uses sounds with the same frequency as the patient's tinnitus to occupy the neurons that would otherwise deliver the tinnitus signal. Practiced alongside counseling, these interventions allow people to reevaluate their relationship with tinnitus. Losing the sound of silence can be troubling, to say the least. Tinnitus reveals that your brain is constantly analyzing the world around you, even as it fails to filter its own internal noise. In a sense, experiencing tinnitus is like eavesdropping on your brain talking to itself, though it may not be a conversation you want to hear.
Listen again.
Arriving home after a long day, you settle in for a quiet evening alone. But instead of the sound of silence, you hear a constant ringing, even though there's nothing making any noise. What you're experiencing is called tinnitus, the perception of a noise like ringing, buzzing, hissing, or clicking that occurs without any external source of sound. Tinnitus has been bothering humanity since ancient Babylon, plaguing everyone from Leonardo da Vinci to Charles Darwin. Today, roughly 1 in 7 people worldwide experiences this auditory sensation. So where does this persistent sound come from? When you normally hear something, sound waves hit various areas of your ear, creating vibrations that displace fluid inside the cochlea. If the vibrations are large enough, they elicit a chemical response that transforms them into bioelectrical signals. These nerve impulses are then relayed through the hearing pathway to the brain, where they result in the sounds we perceive. However, in the vast majority of tinnitus cases, the nerve signals that produce these mysterious sounds don't travel through your ear at all. Instead, they're generated internally by your own central nervous system. Under usual circumstances, these self-produced signals are an essential part of hearing. All mammals demonstrate ongoing neural activity throughout their hearing pathways. When there are no sounds present, this activity is at a baseline that establishes your neural code for silence. When a sound does appear, this activity changes, allowing the brain to distinguish between silence and sound. But the auditory system's health can affect this background signal. Loud noises, diseases, toxins, and even natural aging can damage your cochlear cells. Some of these may heal in a matter of hours. However, if enough cells die, either over time or all at once, the auditory system becomes less sensitive. With fewer cochlear cells relaying information, incoming sounds generate weaker nerve signals, and many environmental sounds can be lost completely. To compensate, your brain devotes more energy to monitoring the hearing pathway. Just like you might adjust the knobs of a radio, the brain modifies neural activity while also tweaking the tuning knob to get a clearer signal. Increasing this background neural activity is intended to help you process weak auditory inputs. But it can also modify your baseline for silence, such that a lack of sound no longer sounds silent at all. This is called subjective tinnitus, and it accounts for the vast majority of tinnitus cases. Subjective tinnitus is a symptom associated with practically every known ear disorder, but it isn't necessarily a bad thing. While its appearance can be surprising, subjective tinnitus has no inherently negative consequences. But for some, tinnitus episodes can trigger traumatic memories or otherwise distressing feelings, which increase the sound's intrusiveness. This psychological loop often leads to what's known as bothersome tinnitus, a condition that can exacerbate the symptoms of PTSD, insomnia, anxiety, and depression. There's no known cure for subjective tinnitus, so the most important thing doctors can do is help people understand this auditory event and develop neutral associations with these often distressing sounds. One form, called informational masking, uses soothing, complex auditory signals that distract the brain from the tinnitus sound. Another, called energetic masking, uses sounds with the same frequency as the patient's tinnitus to occupy the neurons that would otherwise deliver the tinnitus signal. Practiced alongside counseling, these interventions allow people to reevaluate their relationship with tinnitus. Losing the sound of silence can be troubling, to say the least. Tinnitus reveals that your brain is constantly analyzing the world around you, even as it fails to filter its own internal noise. In a sense, experiencing tinnitus is like eavesdropping on your brain talking to itself. though it may not be a conversation you want to hear.
This is the end of task 2. Now turn to task 3. Task 3. Listen to an extract from an interview with dating coach Damona Hoffman about dating apps. Decide if the sentences 1 to 10 are true or false according to the interview. Write your answers, true or false, in the table provided. Sentence 0 is an example. Now you have 1 minute and 30 seconds to read the task.
This is NPR's Life Kit. Hinge and Bumble and Grindr and Lex. Her, J-Date, Match, Tinder, OkCupid, Plenty of Fish. Dating apps are a dime a dozen these days. They come in all different styles and flavors, but offer users the same twinkling hope. Love at first swipe. So, how do you make the most of it? Damona Hoffman is a certified dating coach and host of the Dates and Mates podcast. She's going to give us her best advice for making dating apps and your dating profile work for you.
We are addicted to our stories. And that is often the thing that keeps someone from being able to be successful on a dating app. Whether it's the story of, I don't want to tell my friends that we met on a dating app, or I just didn't picture it. I hear that all of the time. Mm. I just didn't picture meeting my partner on a dating app. So I think it's about embracing this new technology. And as you said, it is not the same as meeting the way that we used to meet. It is a completely new medium and new tool. And if you approach it with the same old-fashioned rules around chivalry and chemistry and whatever your old expectations were, then it's no wonder that you would be disappointed with your results.
So what mindset do you suggest people new to the dating app game adopt? Like, do you find it best when your clients are aggressive as possible and treat every match as a potential life partner?
I think it's important to not take the matches too seriously in the beginning, but to also date with a sense of purpose. And when you have absolute clarity on what you're looking for, and I'm not talking about the checklist, like he must be 6 feet or taller, or make this much money, but what are the qualities of that person? What are their values? How do they look at the world? What are their goals for the future? Those are really the things that I help my clients hone in on before we even get to the dating app. So to specifically answer your question, you should not get attached to any of your matches before you have really met them and gotten to know them. I tell my clients to think of the messages and the swipes like coins in the fountain. Mm. You toss it in and you make a wish. And if it comes true, that's a wonderful thing. You got your wish. And if it doesn't come true, it's just a penny. Are you going to get upset about a penny? That's how you really have to treat those initial messages and only start to get invested as you really get to know somebody offline.
That's great. You have to start by having some intention, having some purpose. Let's turn to specifics. Different apps, as you were alluding to, ask for different things, but what they all have in common is this pressure to make a profile that shows the world your best and brightest and truest self. That's such a hard thing to do. It's such an agonizing process. You know, I've sat with girlfriends for hours and been like, okay, does this skydiving picture send the right message? Does it say the right thing? And if so, where exactly should it be in the Bumble lineup? And what does that say? You know, or wait, don't frame your favorite food response that way. It comes out a little too snarky.
Mm-hmm. The profile is really the most important piece of your online dating experience. That said, I don't want people to stress out about what should go on it, and really look at your dating profile and your dating experience as sort of your love lab of your life. You can test different photos, see how they do. A profile I look at it as a living document. The three C's are color, context, and character. Color is, it's actually strategic to stand out from a sea of swipes. Context, telling your story through your photos, and character, showing your personality.
The other thing I was going to mention is that you have this amazing free resource, Damona, the Dating Profile Starter Kit. Now, I know you've already touched on a lot of those things and we don't have time to go through it line by line, but can you tell us generally what else makes the foundation of a successful dating profile? I know you have some great template language in there. Any other thoughts on that?
Specificity is your best friend on your dating profile. I would rather that you say, I'm more of a night on the town kind of gal, or, you know, I'm a sports fan through and through. Be specific, because that will make you memorable and it will also paint a picture. Remember, we are addicted to storytelling. So we want to paint a picture of what our life is like, what it would be like to get to know us. I also see people wasting a lot of real estate with platitudes and talking about idealized versions of who their mate is. We don't need to say that this person needs to be kind and courteous and trustworthy. That is a given. Now tell me what's a level beneath that, and really tell me those elements that you bring to the table.
What's off limits when it comes to making a dating profile? What are your no-nos for your clients?
Shirtless bathroom selfies, guys. that is definitely a no-no. Filtered or heavily edited photos, okay. Photos that are too old, and share oversharing. Like, sometimes if daters have been online a long time or feel that they've been burned or frustrated with the dating process, many times I can read that through their profile. They'll tell me everything that they don't want instead of what they do want, or every qualification based on disappointing past experiences. We don't need that. We need to keep it positive. What people tend to do is put their filters up right away, put those barriers up, and then you don't get enough options in your dating pipeline.
Listen again.
This is NPR's Life Kit. Hinge and Bumble and Grindr and Lex. Her, J-Date, Match, Tinder, OkCupid, Plenty of Fish. Dating apps are a dime a dozen these days. They come in all different styles and flavors, but offer users the same twinkling hope. Love at first swipe. So, how do you make the most of it? Damona Hoffman is a certified dating coach and host of the Dates and Mates podcast. She's going to give us her best advice for making dating apps and your dating profile work for you.
We are addicted to our stories. And that is often the thing that keeps someone from being able to be successful on a dating app. Whether it's the story of, I don't want to tell my friends that we met on a dating app, or I just didn't picture it. I hear that all of the time. Mm. I just didn't picture meeting my partner on a dating app. So I think it's about embracing this new technology. And as you said, it is not the same as meeting the way that we used to meet. It is a completely new medium and new tool. And if you approach it with the same old-fashioned rules around chivalry and chemistry and whatever your old expectations were, then it's no wonder that you would be disappointed with your results.
So what mindset do you suggest people new to the dating app game adopt? Like, do you find it best when your clients are aggressive as possible and treat every match as a potential life partner?
I think it's important to not take the matches too seriously in the beginning, but to also date with a sense of purpose. And when you have absolute clarity on what you're looking for, and I'm not talking about the checklist, like he must be 6 feet or taller, or right, or make this much money, but what are the qualities of that person? What are their values? How do they look at the world? What are their goals for the future? Those are really the things that I help my clients hone in on before we even get to the dating app. So to specifically answer your question, you should not get attached to any of your matches before you have really met them and gotten to know them. I tell my clients to think of the messages and the swipes like coins in the fountain. Mm. You toss it in and you make a wish. And if it comes true, that's a wonderful thing. You got your wish. And if it doesn't come true, it's just a penny. Are you going to get upset about a penny? That's how you really have to treat those initial messages and only start to get invested as you really get to know somebody offline.
That's great. You have to start by having some intention, having some purpose. Let's turn to specifics. Different apps, as you were alluding to, ask for different things, but what they all have in common is this pressure to make a profile that shows the world your best and brightest and truest self. That's such a hard thing to do. It's such an agonizing process. You know, I've sat with girlfriends for hours and been like, okay, does this skydiving picture send the right message? Does it say the right thing? And if so, where exactly should it be in the Bumble lineup? And what does that say? You know, or wait, don't frame your favorite food response that way. It comes out a little too snarky.
Mm. The profile is really the most important piece of your online dating experience. That said, I don't want people to stress out about what should go on it, and really look at your dating profile and your dating experience as sort of your love lab of your life. You can test different photos, see how they do. A profile, I look at it as a living document. The three C's are color, context, and character. Color is, it's actually strategic to stand out from a sea of swipes. Context, telling your story through your photos, and character, showing your personality.
The other thing I was going to mention is that you have this amazing free resource, Damona, the Dating Profile Starter Kit. Now, I know you've already touched on a lot of those things and we don't have time to go through it line by line, but can you tell us generally what else makes the foundation of a successful dating profile? I know you have some great template language in there. Any other thoughts on that?
Specificity is your best friend on your dating profile. I would rather that you say, I'm more of a night on the town kind of gal, or, you know, I'm a sports fan through and through. be specific because that will make you memorable and it will also paint a picture. Remember, we are addicted to storytelling. So we want to paint a picture of what our life is like, what it would be like to get to know us. I also see people wasting a lot of real estate with platitudes and talking about idealized versions of who their mate is. We don't need to say that this person needs to be kind and courteous and trustworthy. That is a given. Now tell me what's a level beneath that and really tell me those elements that you bring to the table.
What's off limits when it comes to making a dating profile? What are your no-nos for your clients?
Shirtless bathroom selfies, guys. that is definitely a no-no. Filtered or heavily edited photos, okay. Photos that are too old, and share oversharing. Like sometimes if daters have been online a long time or feel that they've been burned or frustrated with the dating process, many times I can read that through their profile. They'll tell me everything that they don't want instead of what they do want, or every qualification based on disappointing past experiences. We don't need that. We need to keep it positive. What people tend to do is put their filters up right away, put those barriers up, and then you don't get enough options in your dating pipeline.
This is the end of task 3 and the end of the listening test.